From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now. Today, Democratic impeachment managers are expected to unveil dramatic new video of the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol as they try to persuade senators that former President Donald Trump should be convicted of inciting the mob that day, even though he is no longer in office. Trump's defense team argued unsuccessfully yesterday that the trial is unconstitutional. The performance was so lackluster that one Republican, Louisiana Senator Bill Cassidy, abandoned his plan to vote against continuing the trial and voted instead to proceed.
If I'm there as an impartial juror, respecting my oath of office to uphold the Constitution of the United States, and one side makes the argument and the other side does everything but make the argument, then to live with myself, I make that vote.
In all, six Republican senators voted to let the trial go on. One question now is, what should we make of Cassidy's switch when it's likely that most Republicans will ultimately vote to acquit the former president? Well, let's put that question to Alice Stewart, a Republican strategist who's advised multiple presidential candidates. So, Alice, what do you think?
Callum, it's great to be with you. Look, Cassidy made some very strong points, and it is clear, anyone who watched the proceedings yesterday, that the House impeachment managers nailed it, and Trump's legal team winged it. And there was very compelling and emotional arguments made on the side of House impeachment managers and making the case for their argument to vote to convict the president, former president, on impeachment. And Cassidy's not alone with regard to his feelings on that. I mean, he was clear yesterday that the House managers were organized and focused. He was joined by Lindsey Graham, who felt the same way. Senator Ted Cruz felt that Raskin was impressive. John Cornyn, Republican of Texas, felt that Trump's legal team just rambled on and on. But, you know, to have Cassidy be the one vote to change his mind since last week is quite telling on how this will play out. And let me just say that six votes to proceed is a far cry from 17 votes needed to convict. And I don't see it changing very much, even though what we're going to see today and as the House managers continue to make their case be compelling and emotional. Emotions weigh high in a court of law, but politics outweighs the day when it comes to a Senate trial for impeachment.
Although I do think it's notable, even if it is unlikely that so many to get to 17 will switch. But Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell reportedly is telling Republicans to vote their conscience in this impeachment trial. And so as the trial proceeds, I'm curious whether you think if senators actually do heed that advice and just vote their conscience, whether there would be enough support to convict the former president.
Time will tell. I mean, we're going to see some very compelling and emotional testimony and video. I do believe this Capitol security camera video will really make the case for impeachment. And I do believe McConnell is sending the right message to Senate Republicans to vote their conscience and not look at this as a political play. And he is not alone in his thinking with regard to we do have a case here to move forward with impeachment based on constitutional grounds. A strong conservative lawyer, Republican lawyer Chuck Cooper, has also made the case that this Trump impeachment trial is constitutional and they can move forward. And it's interesting in some of the comments that McConnell has made that it is not out of the question to think that someone may not have voted to move forward with the trial. But after hearing all the evidence and being an impartial, quote unquote, juror, that they still could vote to convict the former president. I happen to believe that there should be consequences for the former president's actions to invite and incite the insurrection on January 6th. So I would not have a problem with that. But the question is whether or not Senate Republicans will agree with that.
Well, last thing, Alice, just help us pull some of these threads together, because McConnell isn't whipping votes in Trump's favor. We saw Cassidy's switch yesterday. Lindsey Graham, you mentioned, didn't switch, but he's been highly critical and was previously a huge supporter of the former president. So, I mean, how significant is it to see Trump's support weakening in this way, even if he is ultimately acquitted?
It's significant in that McConnell always looks at the long game. And this is not just about continuing to support Donald Trump right now in the short term. This is about going on the record making people understand that inciting an insurrection at the Capitol is an impeachable offense. And I think it's smart and wise that McConnell has made it quite clear that he has not made up his mind how he will vote. And he is, as you say, is not whipping people, not encouraging people to vote one way or the other, but doing what is the right thing to do in a situation like this is encourage Senate Republicans to vote their conscience, listen to the evidence, and make the best decision based on the evidence that they hear in this trial.
All right. Alice Stewart, Republican strategist. We'll have to leave it there. Thanks for your time, as always.
Thanks, Callum.
Let's go to Lebanon now, which is on the verge of collapse. Health officials there are in the grips of one of the world's worst outbreaks of COVID-19 and the middle of an ongoing economic crisis. Intensive care units are full and people are scrambling for basic needs like medicines, baby formula, and ventilators. Joining us for more is Borzu Daragahi. He's an international correspondent for the British newspaper The Independent. Borzu, welcome.
It's my pleasure.
Lebanon's latest surge killed almost as many people in January as died from the disease all last year. How did it get so bad?
It mostly has to do with the decision on the part of the Lebanese government to open the country up for the Christmas and New Year's holidays. Many Lebanese live abroad and they come home just for the holidays. The tourism and hotel and nightclub industries were adamant that the country should open up and allow them to recoup some of their losses. And so the government made the decision under pressure from these powerful players to open up, encourage the Lebanese living abroad to come home. They came, they partied, they went to house parties, they went to nightclubs, they created a super spreader event. You know, my colleague is in Beirut and, you know, she was in the emergency rooms. The emergency rooms are flooded. They're running out of oxygen even.
Mm. Then there was this lockdown in place. This week, they partially lifted this after major protests. But what is life like there right now?
I mean, things are really tough. You have multiple crises kind of converging on each other. You have the collapse of the economy that has been caused by irresponsibility in the banking sector that has caused the currency to just collapse. You have a political crisis. Listeners may recall massive protests last year over the state of corruption and so on. And you have the lingering after effects, it must be said, of this terrible blast last August at the Beirut port, which destroyed some of the most desirable quarters in the capital and really upended people's lives and so on. Meanwhile, you have a state that, you know, over the decades is not able to help out the people who are suffering any of these crises. You know, Lebanon does not have a lot of oil revenue. It doesn't have a big sovereign wealth fund. There's not a big social welfare net. People make it in Lebanon by hustling. They're small business people. They own little shops. They make little deals. They are on the phone all the time. Anyone who knows Lebanon knows Lebanese people. It's a very entrepreneurial country. And these lockdowns really put a hamper on that. And that really restricts people's ability to make a living. And there's nothing to fall back on. And that really creates a lot of tension and it creates a lot of problems for ordinary people.
Is Lebanon able to get any help from other countries or international organizations?
It's still unresolved. But, you know, there is talk of giving Lebanon an IMF loan. But the tension is that because the IMF had wanted certain conditions on giving the loan, there was questions as to whether that money would come through. There's not a lot of international help for anyone these days. Since the 2008 economic crisis, the international lending institutions, international development banks have become even less generous than they were before. And so it's a really tough situation. No, there's not a lot of help for Lebanon.
You mentioned the August explosion in Beirut's harbor. What is the latest on that investigation?
Well, there is a judge who is trying to investigate this case and trying to bring some measure of justice. But there are also reports that many of the powerful players in the country are hindering it. You have reports, for example, that witnesses to the blast are being warned and threatened, not to mention Hezbollah, the Iranian-backed militia group, in their testimony. And then, you know, in the background of all this, there's these new findings. I don't know if listeners have heard about this, but a German company in a deal with Lebanon agreed to find and remove any other potential chemical hazards from the port. And they found a lot, tons of potentially explosive materials. The head of the German company that was assigned to kind of remove this stuff and take it for disposal said that it was still a ticking time bomb, that they were shocked. They'd seen nothing like this in their whole career of removing these kinds of chemicals from hazardous sites.
That's Borzu Daragahi, international correspondent for The Independent. Thank you so much for this update.
It's been a pleasure.
If you've been working from home, please wait for your vaccine. That's an argument from Stephen Thrasher, a professor at Northwestern University, who recently wrote an op-ed for the Scientific American. He believes it's unethical to step in line in front of people who make it possible for so many of us to stay indoors: healthcare workers, delivery drivers, cashiers. But Lindsay Wiley with American University says relying on personal responsibility is a surefire way to mismanage a pandemic. Wiley is the director of the Health Law and Policy Program at the university's Washington College of Law, and she joins us now. Lindsay, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yes. So we've heard this idea before that Thrasher is making, that those more insulated from the pandemic and not medically compromised, we should note that, shouldn't skip the line to get a vaccine ahead of others who face the risk of infection daily. And this comes, as we've seen, many people are finding ways to jump the line. Your thoughts on this?
Well, I think it's complicated. It depends a lot on the kind of gray area about what does it mean to jump the line, because the line has gotten pretty big, right? And it's gotten pretty wide. Governors have expanded eligibility far more rapidly than guidelines from the CDC recommended that they should at a time when doses are really very scarce. And so, you know, some folks may be thinking about misrepresenting themselves as falling within the categories that are eligible, but others, it may just be a matter of, you know, technically I'm eligible, but so are a lot of other people who are at higher risk than I am. And my argument is that if it's safe for you, if you have the option of staying home for a little longer, it's better to wait when you're in a group with a lot of people who may be equally eligible, but not equally at risk.
You also say there's a difference between highlighting anecdotal ethical failures and then shifting the blame of the vaccine's slow overall rollout to individuals. Where do you think the responsibility lies in distributing the vaccine?
I have repeatedly referred to this as a personal responsibility pandemic. I think we've seen it again and again where institutional leaders and elected officials have tried to shift the blame and shift the responsibility for making difficult choices onto individuals. We've seen it with masks, where, you know, the idea was that if everybody would wear their masks, this would all end immediately, when, you know, the evidence really wasn't strong that would be enough by itself. I really resent a situation where we're all turning on each other and our leaders are encouraging us to do that instead of holding our institutions and governments accountable for society-wide choices, for systemic responses, and most importantly, for implementing a modern public health response that doesn't depend so much on each of us making these impossible choices at the individual level.
Hmm. Really, has the vaccine distribution system, as we know it right now, failed those, do you think, who need it most?
I think it has. I think we're seeing indication of that across states, across cities, across the country, and across the globe, that, you know, the people whose vaccination will make the biggest difference, the fastest, in reducing hospitalizations and deaths are having some of the greatest difficulty accessing vaccines. I, as someone who is at relatively low risk of COVID compared to many others, I may actually benefit more from hospital capacity being protected, so that if I, you know, slip and fall and hurt my head, I'm more likely to get the care that I need. But we're all very focused on, you know, feeling like we've got to navigate this difficult system. And so it creates this sense that if we're not fighting hard for our place in line, everybody else is, and we're sort of the ones who are going to get left behind. And that ignores, though, that we really do expect to transition from scarcity of vaccine doses to abundance, you know, relatively rapidly over the course of the next few months. a few months' time can make a huge difference for people who are in high-risk groups and are either themselves in high-exposure situations because of work or living conditions, or live with people who are in high-exposure groups. They really don't have the time to wait. A few months difference really is life or death. Whereas for someone like me who has the, you know, who's fortunate to have the ability to work from home, who's fortunate to live in a household where I can stay relatively safe, I can afford to wait, and I should.
So your take home message is, as you told us in the beginning, it's complicated. But really, as an individual, you're telling us if you can wait, wait. If you can't, don't wait. But then what should we call on for our officials who are in charge of these distribution systems? What would you tell individuals to do when it comes to really pushing them to find the right systems? It just depends on where you live. I mean, some places people have been able to get them right away, and others, they're still waiting.
I think we've seen some really good models out there across the country for how to do this right. And one thing to keep in mind is equity and public health criteria and prioritization of particular groups, it doesn't have to look like policing whether somebody has the right documents so that only the right people are showing up in response to some kind of mass cattle call. It looks like targeting vaccinations by sending the doses and sending the vaccinators to hard-hit areas. That's what a public health approach to prioritization looks like, and it shouldn't be understood as standing in the way of the public health goal of achieving herd immunity when we have enough doses. Right now, we only have enough doses to vaccinate between 10 and 30% of the population over the next few months. And when that's the case, we've got to use those doses wisely to reduce hospitalizations and deaths. Eventually, every person's vaccination will help equally for the goal of achieving herd immunity, but that's just not where we are right now with our supply.
Lindsay Wiley, Director of the Health Law and Policy Program at American University's Washington College of Law. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, so you may have heard the concern about whether pregnant women should get the COVID-19 vaccine. The CDC says yes, the vaccine should be available to pregnant women, but they should consult with their doctor first. While the World Health Organization initially said pregnant women should not get it unless they're at high risk, they've since agreed with the CDC. This confusion lies in the fact that pregnant women were not part of clinical trials for the vaccine. Currently, according to Dr. Anthony Fauci, more than 20,000 pregnant women have already gotten it with no problems reported. To understand these somewhat conflicting messages between the WHO and the CDC, we called up Dr. Chirsty Agard, a maternal fetal medicine specialist at the Children's Hospital in Texas. She says, bottom line, there's no reason to think the Moderna and Pfizer-BioNTech vaccines are harmful to pregnant women.
There's not even underlying biology or scientific rationale why they would be unsafe.
But is this lack of data enough assurance that they're safe? To parse out this a little bit more, I asked Dr. Agard why she thinks the CDC and the WHO had taken different stances.
First of all, the absence of data does not equal the potential for risk. Absence of data is just absence of data. And because pregnant women weren't invited nor allowed to enroll in the trials, we don't have that data. To now say, in the absence of data, we shouldn't offer this to all pregnant women, to me seems like double jeopardy for women who are at high risk of having greater hospitalizations and adverse outcomes if they acquire COVID-19.
And you're saying that just by virtue of being pregnant, they're at higher risk?
Correct. So pregnant women have about 5 times the risk of being hospitalized if they get COVID-19. They have 3 to 4 times the risk of requiring intensive care unit stays and life-saving measures, and they have a higher rate of death. This risk is further disproportionately experienced by women who are Black or Latino. So we have a disparity in risk of adverse outcomes and death by women just by virtue of them being pregnant, ignoring all other risk factors.
I understand what you're saying, but I'm also putting myself in a pregnant woman's shoes. You only have 9 months of gestation, and for some it might feel like a risk because there is no data around the potential effects of a vaccine on a pregnant woman. I mean, What are you hearing from your pregnant patients?
So the two things I'm hearing quite a bit about are first from pregnant women who received the vaccine, who are now kind of coming back in and saying, wait a minute, is there a risk? To which we say, there's none that we're aware of. And then we really spend some time kind of doing, you know, Bill Nye the Science Guy discussion about why we can't imagine that that risk would exist. And what I found with my patients is when we sit down and take the time to go through it step by step, they walk away reassured.
Well, we know that uncertainty can breed fear, which makes it very easy for misinformation to spread. Are you worried that pregnant women will hear this and hear these conflicting messages about the vaccine and what that could actually mean in really getting at this virus?
I think you're absolutely correct. And I think clearly it's going to have two effects. If we continue to confuse lack of data with presence of risk. So creating a sense of crisis where women must weigh risk and benefit is kind of a false discussion to have. The real discussion to have is what is the true benefit to receiving the vaccine and the science behind that.
That's Dr. Chersti Agard, a maternal fetal specialist at the Texas Children's Hospital. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for being willing to talk about it so that women can make the choices that will benefit them and their developing babies the best.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
How do we reinvent ourselves? And what's the secret to living longer? I'm Anoush Zomorodi. Each week on NPR's TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey with TED speakers to seek a deeper understanding of the world and to figure out new ways to think and create. Listen now.
A team of researchers with the World Health Organization concluded a 28-day mission in Wuhan this week, seeking clues about the origins of COVID-19. They say bats remain a likely source, and add it's worth investigating the possibility of transmission through frozen food. Drew Joseph is with our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. And Drew, the frozen food theory is a favorite of the Chinese government because it suggests the virus could have been imported to China instead of originating there. So what did the WHO researchers say about this idea?
Yeah, I think what's important to take away is that they said the most likely cause of, or the most likely origin of the pandemic is likely a coronavirus that probably evolved in bats and then maybe passed to another animal source and then to humans. The frozen food thing has been speculated about. It's been pushed by the Chinese government, as you mentioned. You know, it's really hard to rule out, like it's kind of hard to prove a negative. But most experts think that is pretty unlikely to be a source of transmission, like even since the origin of the pandemic.
And as we've been learning in recent months, it really is a virus that spreads most easily through the air and less so on surfaces. But more broadly, Drew, I mean, when it comes to cold temperatures, what do we know about how that affects virus transmission? Does that help it spread more easily?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of like the cold weather, definitely. Think about like cold and flu season. Respiratory viruses just spread better in cold, dry climates. But I think in terms of the question of like frozen packaging and stuff, there is some evidence that the virus can survive for some amount of time on frozen packaging. But whether that in turn leads to cases is a different question.
Well, that's a good point because China has said they've detected the virus on frozen food packaging, but there is a difference between that and actually confirming that that caused an infection in people. Are there cases where we know that somebody got sick based on picking up the virus on frozen food packages?
Yeah, I mean, and other countries have said that they're investigating that as a potential source of introduction of cases, but I'm not sure if it's ever been 100% confirmed as a route of transmission. I think it's important to remember that sometimes when you test a package, say, and you find a trace of the virus, what you might be finding is just a little bit of its genetic code. And that's actually separate from a sample of live virus that can actually infect people. And China has said it's found live virus on packages, but it's really not likely to be a main source of transmission. It's pretty unlikely, I would say.
And one of the complicating factors, of course, is that the people who are part of the cold supply chain who are handling the packages may be also working in close quarters. So if they contract the virus, it can be hard to know whether it came off the package or perhaps through the air from a coworker. As far as everyday consumers go, though, Drew, folks are going to be listening and wondering, so do I need to be worried about the frozen food packages I'm getting at the grocery store? I mean, what should those folks be thinking about?
Yeah, I think at the beginning of the pandemic, before it became clear just how much of transmission is through the air, like you were saying, there was a sense of, oh, maybe you should wipe down everything that comes in the mail or you get from the grocery store. And that type of transmission is called fomites. That's what's sort of like the virus that's left on a package, for example, or left on a surface. I think it's been shown throughout the pandemic that, you know, it's not a main driver of cases. It's pretty unlikely. You're much more likely to contract it, you know, by being in the same room with someone who's infectious just because you're sharing the air.
So more important to wear your mask to the grocery store than to be worried about wiping down the packages once you get back home. That's Drew Joseph with our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. Drew, thanks for your time.
Thanks so much.
If you're looking for a beautifully written, engrossing read, the critically acclaimed novel Dear Edward is out on paperback this month. The book was inspired by a plane crash in Libya in which one Dutch boy survived. Author Anne Napolitano wrote a fictionalized version in which a 12-year-old boy named Eddie loses his parents and older brother in a crash of a flight to Los Angeles. But as the only survivor, he gains the hopes and dreams of the families of those who died and struggles to figure out, why me? Napolitano weaves the stories together with the stories of the doomed passengers as they fly toward their fate, including a war veteran and a young woman who finds out on the flight that she's pregnant. Dear Edward was a bestseller and made numerous best books of 2020 lists after it came out in January of that year. Anne Napolitano spoke with Robin Young when the book was published.
Take us back. What was that terrible crash that so obsessed you?
It was in 2010. It was a flight from South Africa bound for London, and it crashed in Libya. And there was only one survivor. It was a 9-year-old Dutch boy named Ruben Van Assau. And basically, his seat was found about a half mile away from the rest of the wreckage, and he was still buckled in, and he had a punctured lung and a broken leg, but he was otherwise fine. Mm. And his brother and his parents had been on the flight, and everyone else had died immediately. Mm. And I could not read enough about this story. I had two little boys at the time, a 1-year-old and a 3-year-old, and there was a photo of Ruben in the hospital, and he was so beautiful and broken and yet alive and okay that I felt like I needed to make a world in which he could walk forward and have a life in mm-hmm. which something like that, if it had happened to one of my boys, that I could imagine a future for them.
Well, that's what you say in the afterword, that it was also inspired by thinking of your own two boys. And, you know, we think of family and what would this be like? But a lot of people can't go toward that thought. You know, they want to stay as far away from it as possible. Here you spend years making yourself think, what would this be like? What was that like?
I think it's a preoccupation with like what your worst nightmare would be and then finding a way to make it okay. So it was trying to create a world that was so imbued with kindness that there was a way for this boy to find a way forward.
Mm. And we don't want to give away too many of the plot twists, but let's just give a little of the narrative. He's a New York City kid, homeschooled by his dad along with his brother Jordan, who he adores, his older, slightly cooler brother. Plays the piano, shy. Suddenly he's in a hospital bed and people are asking him, how are you doing? And you write, Edward is unable to answer any of these questions. He can't consider how he's feeling. That door is far too dangerous to open. Did you do research? Because after reading your book, I did, you know, Google around, and there are articles about sole survivors. There's one, George Lamson Jr. in 1985, the only one to survive a crash that killed 71 in Reno, Nevada. Did you research what survivors go through?
Yes, I'm a nervous flyer. I never thought that I would write a book about a plane crash. So I had to do an extensive amount of research. I spoke to a pilot. I did a lot of reading. I read National Transportation Safety Board transcripts, which is the national organization that after every major tragedy, they publish a document that says basically what the issue was, what went wrong. I read and talked to as many people as I could because I was coming from a place of very little knowledge. And also, I wanted it to feel true. I didn't want to sensationalize the crash. I wanted it to have the weight that it actually has in the people's lives who lose someone and the people who are on the plane themselves.
You take us through this terrible cascade of mistakes that leads to the crash. But back to Eddie. Eddie becomes Edward. It's as if almost Eddie has died with his whole family. He's adopted by his aunt and uncle, who have their own pain. His aunt, of course, lost her sister, Eddie's mother, but she's also been trying to have children, not successfully. His uncle becomes obsessed with researching the crash. Along the way, when they're first trying to keep him away from the public that's so fascinated with him, he sort of gets treated a little bit like a hotel guest. Did you research that as well, that how people don't know how, people don't know what to do?
Well, I did read a lot about soul survivors, but more it was coming from a place of even if your spouse dies and you enter a room, people do not know what to say to you. And this was magnified times a million. And he was a child as well, so the adults couldn't even begin to understand where he might be. And so they're so careful around him. And that leads to the importance of there's a girl who lives next door named Shay, who's his age. And he ends up sleeping on her floor because he needs to be by another kid because he misses his brother so much. Mm. And he, also because she treats him like a normal person because she's a child herself.
At one point, he just can't go to a hearing in Washington, D.C. about the plane crash. And she says, well, no one there can hurt you. I mean, you already lost everything, right? You know, like,
She speaks the truth to him, whereas the grown-ups are more withholding.
He also has, in addition to the guilt, and we'll talk about that, he has PTSD when he's forced to go to gym class and play basketball. People bumping into him, it's like a plane crash all over again. I mean, he has a physical response.
Yes. When he's in the hospital after the crash, one of the doctors says to the aunt and uncle that the effects could last for years and it could affect his smell, his balance, his understanding of the world around him. You just don't know when the symptoms were going to hit and how they were going to hit. And really, he's 12 when the plane crashes. And when the book ends, he's 18. And it takes that long of all these tiny steps, both forward and backward, of him trying to make his way to a world where he feels connected again and where he's able to love again and able to accept love. Because it's not a quick process. No. I mean, it just wouldn't be.
It's years. I mean, we watch him grow taller and taller and taller, and he's still wrestling with this. You know, just another moment with Shay, because she's so blunt. She says to, now, Edward, he shouldn't worry about taking another flight because he's already crashed, and it's statistically impossible for him to crash twice. And you write, Edward barely registers what she said. He's been sucker-punched in that moment by memories of his brother. And he knows he has to ride the memories out. The only way out of it is through it. So he sees Jordan beside him on the plane, knows that the smallest, truest reason he will never fly again is that the last airplane seat he ever sits in has to be the one beside his brother. That, you know, brings us to this guilt he feels, this, like, why me? Obviously another consequence of, you know, being a survivor.
Yeah, and he's the younger brother, too. So, of course, as his therapist points out to him, his brother was 15 and he was 12. And 15-year-olds have more developed personality than 12-year-olds do. And so Eddie, along with missing his brother with every fiber of his being, also feels that his brother had more to offer than he does. So he has to work through both emotions throughout the book.
And in all the research we did, you probably found the same thing. The one way to get through is to do something for someone else. And we're not going to give it away, but he sure does. But in the meantime, there are a couple sidebars here. People who just want to make him something he's not. He's just a kid. When he leaves the hospital, for instance, there's a mob scene. So many eyes stare at Edward, the scene looks like a Picasso painting, hundreds of eyeballs, and then a smattering of limbs and hairstyles. He realizes he's famous. You've written that you were fascinated by the social media part of this.
Yes, in 2010, it actually was the first time that social media had become kind of what we understand it to be today. So when that crash happened, the real crash, there were young girls who had posted pages for Ruben, with pictures of him and talking about how devastated they were and how they hoped he was okay. It wasn't just the journalists reporting. It was everyone. I mean, I think people were looking for connection. Yeah. And they're looking for meaning. And so they were trying to put that on Edward, which is an inappropriate place to put it since he was a young boy who had just lost everything.
It would be inappropriate to put it on anybody. Nobody can be who the families of the victims want them to be. And you have a great response. I won't say which character tells Eddie this, but at one point someone says, oh, you're nothing special. There's absolutely no reason why you survived this. And it's such a relief.
Yeah, it's a huge gift.
Yeah. How about for you, Anne Napolitano? Did you lose some of your fear of flying?
No, I probably am about the same. I'm still a nervous flyer. I think that I have a greater appreciation for how amazing it is that we can launch these giant buses up into the air and fly where we want to go. I think that is truly awesome. But I also look around at the passengers around me and wonder what their stories are. I feel like I'm aware of connections everywhere I go, and in the air, certainly no exception.
Yeah, that's so interesting because that's what I did. I just,
every time
I met a new character while I was reading your book while flying, I would look around and think to myself, I should look at all these people around me. You know, we're in this together. And yeah, let's see them. Let's see them. Anne Napolitano, her new book, Dear Edward, it's really quite something. Anne, thank you so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you so much.
Anne Napolitano speaking with Robin Young in January of 2020. Dear Edward is now out on paperback.
Nearly all colleges and universities with more than 2,500 students operate their own law enforcement agencies, and there's a movement on some campuses to defund and disband those police departments. At the University of Illinois, students of color say they're over-policed, while police officers say they're a necessary part of college life. From member station WILL, Lee Gaines reports.
When I say officer, y'all say overseer. Officer!
Overseer!
Officer!
Overseer!
About 60 people gathered outside the police department at the University of Illinois' Urbana campus last fall. They wore masks and banged on pots and pans, and they had a message for campus police: you're not welcome here. This is Senior William Burke.
I was skating down Green Street 3 weeks ago, skateboarding, right? Turn right on 4th. What happens? I get pulled over, and five other cops showed up no shorter than 3 minutes after that. I was skateboarding.
Burke was given a warning by campus police that says he ran two red lights. He disputes that. Burke says as a black student, campus police make him feel threatened, and that's why he wants them gone.
I'm paying this money to go to this school. I'm putting in my time to go here, and then they have cops there to just make me know that even though I go here and this is my school, it's not my place. But that's how it feels to me, at least.
Burke started referring to himself as a police abolitionist after George Floyd, a black man, was killed by a white police officer in Minneapolis last May. A lot of students I talked to say that's what propelled them into this movement. And now they want the U of I to take the $8-plus million they spend on police every year and put it into mental health and other services for students. University of Illinois police officer Kyle Krikovich's salary is part of that multi-million-dollar budget. Krikovich says every night on the job is unique, like the Friday night last October when he got this call from dispatch.
So there's a dumpster fire.
It turns out to be a big dumpster fire, and it's threatening an apartment building. So Krikovich grabs the fire extinguisher in his squad car and puts it out. He also helped a couple students whose car ran out of gas and wrote a traffic ticket to a teenage driver during the 4 late-night hours I spent with him.
I'm definitely giving you a citation again just based on the
Krikovich is in his mid-20s. He's been a campus police officer for nearly 3 years. He grew up in the area and graduated from the U of I.
This is home, and I want to make sure that everyone that comes here, whether they're from Chicago or they're an international student coming from, you know, China or wherever, that they feel that this is home too and that they can be safe and get the education that they want.
Krikovich says he doesn't stop or pull people over because of their race, and the chief of the department says none of her officers do. But here's what the University of Illinois Police Department's arrest data shows. Between 2016 and 2019, more than 50% of the people taken to jail by campus police were Black. Black students make up about 7% of the U of I student body, and Black people make up about 12% of the Champaign-Urbana metro area population. Most UIPD officers are white. I asked Chief Alice Carey why Black people are overrepresented in the department's arrest data. She told me systemic racism in other parts of society, like housing and health care, contribute to the high numbers of people of color getting arrested.
You know, we don't dictate who commits crime. It doesn't come with a color. It comes with an act.
Carey says the department is taking steps to engage with communities of color more frequently and hired a social worker to help campus police respond to mental health crises. But she says university cops are necessary to protect university property and anyone on campus.
People can call to defund police, but what is the alternative? You can't take us away and leave society, you know, without resources.
Abolitionists argue there is an alternative to policing. Dylan Rodriguez is a professor at the University of California, Riverside. He's also part of a movement to defund campus police at UC campuses. Rodriguez says abolitionists want a system focused on giving people the resources they need to prevent crime.
And I'm talking about mass shootings. I'm talking about sexual violence. I'm talking about so-called property crime. There's all different kinds of ways to prevent that stuff from actually happening. That then eliminates the need for a reactive police force that gets on the scene when the damage is already done.
Latrell Crawford agrees. He's another student at the U of I calling on the administration to defund and abolish its police force. Crawford is Black, and when he imagines a police-free campus, he feels safer.
With policing and the stereotypes and, you know, being here, it's hard to do that when you don't even feel safe. Like, I don't feel safe. Comfortably walking on the campus. I want to be able to do that freely without, you know, the stereotypes existing, the systems existing that oppress us and marginalize us.
Crawford says students at the University of Illinois plan to continue to agitate so that one day all students will feel welcome on campus regardless of their identity. For Here and Now, I'm Lee Gaines.
And this note, WILL is licensed to the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. The station's editorial content and direction are independent of the university. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Callum Borchers.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now.